12 weeks for £12. Subscribe to The Spectator for this excellent deal and get a £20 Amazon voucher at www.spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week, we ask a few of our brilliant writers to read out their piece from the magazine. This week, Dominic Green, Spectator's deputy US editor, looks at whether Joe Biden will build on or unravel Donald Trump's foreign policy. Choosing the latter would represent a win for arrant wokery, he says. Tanya Gold also features. She reads her interview with Belle Delphine, a pink-haired 21-year-old online sensation who earns more than $1 million a month from the videos she posts online. Our columnist Lionel Shriver is on after, arguing that no one wins from identity politics. Finally, Bruce Anderson reads his drinks column and explains why you can't trust supermarket cheese. First up, Dominic Green.
Joe Biden talks a lot about restoring America's standing in the world, but the awkward truth is that if he now has the chance to reshape America's relationships for a new era, it's because Donald Trump has already done the awkward stuff. The question is, can Biden and his team swallow their collective pride and build on Trump's legacy, or will vanity and partisanship send the American Atlas tumbling to his knees? Trump won the 2016 elections by forcing the difficult questions onto the national agenda. In office, he developed an alternative to the spent consensus of the 1990s. Call it vulgar realism, the lowest common denominator of American interest. He named and shamed the self-dealing swamp creatures of Washington, D.C. Corrupt politicians, complacent bureaucrats, thoughtless think tankers, the bottom-feeding media. He named and shamed the follies and false friends with which the Washington consensus, and especially the Obama administration, had tied America's hands and had set it stumbling towards second-rank status. Open borders and outsourced factories, the Paris and Iran deals, the freeloaders in NATO, the fantasists at the UN. Trump's critics have a point when they complain that he was better at breaking ties than making them. They're right to complain that if the boss had troubled to read the manual before yanking the levers of domestic policy making, and if the staffing of the White House hadn't resembled a particularly savage episode of The Apprentice, he might have achieved more with less fuss. Still, Trump cleared the ground. And he did more than lay the foundations of a new foreign policy. The outlines of the new architecture are already visible in the Pacific and from the Himalayas to the Atlantic. They would surely have developed further had Trump won in November. As it is, the one-term outsider has arguably the most successful foreign policy of any president since the end of the Cold War. He avoided new wars in the Middle East and did his best to end the old ones. He took a tough line on Russia, but not so tough it pushed Russia into an alliance with China. He left the deeply flawed Iran deal and approached the Iranian regime with deterrence, not bribes. And he capitalized on luck and timing to facilitate the reconciliation of the Sunni Arab states and Israel. This breakthrough not only gives the job of confronting Iran to those to whom it matters most, it also contains the seeds of transformation in a Middle East where the oil is running out and the Islamists are losing their appeal. Above all, Trump did the world a favour by standing up to China's menace. He drew an explicit link between a US foreign policy that refused to take Chinese ambitions seriously and free trade policies that encouraged the outsourcing of production east. Trump used America's purchasing habit as leverage against China. In December last year, after 2 years of tariffs and recriminations, the two countries concluded phase one of a new trade deal. China committed to buy more US exports, increase US companies' access to its financial services markets, and expand its intellectual property law. Phase two was to include tougher issues, such as technology transfers, industrial subsidies, and data restriction. Deferred at the time, deferred again by the lost year of COVID, phase two may now be deferred permanently by the Biden administration. China is going to eat our lunch? Come on, man, Biden said on the campaign trail in Iowa last year. They're not competition for us. For Biden, the last of the Cold Warriors, the arc of history is perpetually bending towards American supremacy, the rest of the world perpetually progressing towards humanity's last leap, the end state of becoming American. Trump barely talked about China's repression of the Uyghurs, and he recognized that while the US was still big enough to go it alone, it was no longer strong enough to force everyone else to come along. For Biden, however, America remains the paramount world power. The purpose of foreign policy is not the securing of domestic prosperity, but the export of the American way. Trump objects to China as an economic and military threat. Biden's objections are moral. On free trade and outsourcing, as on the Iraq War, he was chronically in favor of it until he was against it. But Xi Jinping, he says, is a thug who doesn't have a democratic bone in his body. So Biden promises to hold a summit for democracy to reinforce norms that no longer exist with states that no longer hold the balance of global power. Under Biden, behind a screen of right-on rhetoric, America will step back from the confrontational policies that Trump's national security strategy of 2018 called strategic competition. In a paper published in September last year, Jake Sullivan, Biden's pick for national security advisor, and his co-author, the Obama-era diplomat Kurt M. Campbell, argued that the US should seek a steady state of clear-eyed coexistence with China through competition and cooperation. A united democratic front under American leadership, Sullivan and Campbell believe, will force China to either curb its free riding and start complying with trade rules, or accept less favorable terms from more than half of the global economy. But not so unfavorable as to balkanize the lucrative flows of knowledge and talent in the global technology ecosystem. The unipolar world is gone. Trump's policies are only one of the accelerants that hastened its departure. And the global technology system is already splitting into the lines of a new Cold War, Google and Facebook versus Baidu and Weibo. In November, 15 Asian and Pacific countries signed a massive trade deal, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which binds American allies like Japan, South Korea, Australia, New Zealand, Singapore and the Philippines into a low-tariff trade zone with China. This will speed up the concentration of Asian supply chains within the Pacific region, and it will reduce America's leverage over the Pacific democracies. Now, the Europeans are on board with Biden's cant about democracy. They correctly understand it as an effort to revive the liberal internationalist order on America's dime. Nostalgic and cynical, they want the American Atlas to do the heavy lifting. But Biden shouldn't expect much in return. Germany, the EU's largest economy, is actively soliciting business from China, pursuing its habitual energy diplomacy with Russia, and deepening its relationship with Turkey. Unlike France and, after coercion, Britain, Germany refuses to rule out buying 5G from Huawei. In late November, while Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, was flattering Joe Biden as a committed transatlanticist, Angela Merkel was promising Xi that she would step up efforts to conclude negotiations for an EU-China investment deal by the end of the year. Merkel also remains committed to Nord Stream 2, the gas pipeline from Russia. A bipartisan consensus in the US Congress has ruled that this will damage Europe's energy independence. American influence in Europe is further reduced by Brexit and Emmanuel Macron's neo-Gaullist France First foreign policy. Before Brexit, Britain was a reliably pro-American voice in Europe. That made Britain an asset to the US, but an obstacle to the revival of Europe's political independence. That's why de Gaulle said no to Britain joining the common market in 1963 and 1967, and it's also why Macron is pushing now for a hard line in the Brexit negotiations to finally dislodge American influence from the EU. If Biden can't revert to America's old alliances in Europe and Asia, and if, as he seems to intend, America will chase after the fool's errand of bringing back the Iran deal, what can he do? He can play to the domestic gallery. He can nominate a recently retired general, Lloyd Austin III, as the first black Secretary of Defense. A pleasing symbol which deflects questions about the role of his incoming Secretary of State, the very white Antony Blinken, in public-private consulting for Pentagon contracts. Or Biden can announce the formation of the first all-female press team, an innovation which won't exactly force China to drop its claim to the Spratly Islands. He can promise labor unions and environmental lobbyists will be at the table in future trade negotiations with Beijing. Good luck with that. Jake Sullivan, Biden's choice for national security advisor, says he's been told to reimagine national security to include the pandemic, the economic crisis, the climate crisis, technological disruptions, threats to democracy, racial injustice, and inequality in all forms. America, Sullivan says, cannot be a strong and effective actor in the world if we are not a strong and just society and an inclusive economy and a vibrant democracy at home. A successful foreign policy, Sullivan reckons, means investing in inclusive economic growth, a euphemism for race-based subsidies, and overcoming the scourge of systemic racism after 400 years. This represents the total defeat of foreign policy realism, the reality of the world outside America, even, by arrant wokery. The virtue Sullivan intends to signal means nothing to China, other than confirming its impression of American decadence. It means less and less to America's allies, other than suggesting America will be even more unreliable in future, as it now has two foreign policies, each subject to the moods of the party in power and each devoted primarily to annulling the other's achievements. It does, however, mean a lot to that unlikely domestic alliance, the foreign policy blob in Washington and the Democrats' activist base. The Democratic elites have learnt nothing and forgotten everything. They have substituted the failed exceptionalism of the 1990s and the War on Terror, America as the warrior of democracy and the world as its battlefield, with a more deluded exceptionalism, the world as a blank canvas for the projection of a campus drama of racial guilt-tripping and redistributive taxation. Instead of swallowing its pride and building on Trump's achievements, the Biden administration is promising to erase every trace of the orange infamy, regardless of the cost. This is government by buzzword. As foreign policies go, it's got as much chance of succeeding as a Black Lives Matter protest in Beijing.
That was Dominic Green. And now, Tanya Gold.
Belle Delphine lives in a mock Tudor house in a gated community in Hove. It's necrotic and soothing. You could be anywhere, and this is apt. Belle lives on the internet, where she entertains her subscribers who pay $35 a month to the website OnlyFans. She is 21 and she grew up on the internet. It raised me, she says. I watch one of her films before we meet. It shows her dressed as a Disney princess in a long pink wig and small clothes. She attacks herself with paint and rides a fluffy unicorn while shouting. Is the unicorn the internet? Is she the unicorn? I hate the film. The childishness makes me uncomfortable. But it isn't for me. I make my husband watch it and demand he describes his emotional response. He makes a strangled noise. I make a male friend watch it too. He buries his head in his iPhone and vapes furiously. Belle isn't a garden variety performer. She's almost a performative artist, and the joke is almost on the punters, who pay for a girlfriend experience, which means she delivers updates on the life she doesn't have because she is faking one for them. But she plays with them. She promises a video of herself stroking a big cock. It's a chicken, a hen actually, because she can't find a cog. She sold jars of her used bathwater for $30. She looks very clean, though I doubt people who worry about hygiene order bathwater from women in Hove on the internet. They sold out in 3 days. Belle is an internet archetype because she is so open to it. Other vloggers, video bloggers, posted videos of themselves vaping the bathwater. A Spectator colleague drank some, but he's young. This interview is arranged by her partner, whom she asked me not to name. I knock on the wrong door, and a bewildered middle-aged man points me up the hill, though I wonder if he is really Belle Delphine, hoax upon hoax. The partner opens the door. He is young. He looks tired. The house is covered in tableau, pink balloons arranged round a chair, Harry Potter artefacts. It's a child's bedroom, spread across a comfortable suburban house. She looks nothing like the girl in the video, and I'm glad, because I can't interview someone half-nude on a unicorn faking a tantrum. Her hair is long and brown, and she is dressed in casual clothes. She is luminously pretty. She has a soft, squeaky voice. Her real name is Mary. She grew up in Cape Town. Her parents divorced, and she was taken to Lymington in Hampshire by her mother. She doesn't see her father, but I guess that from a lyric in the film. Little tits, big ass, no dad. At school, she wanted to be liked so much, I would injure myself just to make them laugh. I had a swing in the garden and I would fall off it to make them happy. She's still doing that. She left at 14 after being bullied online. She was treated for depression and eventually made friends online. She met these new friends wearing extraordinary clothes. She dressed as Lolita. She likes pink because unhappy children find it hard to grow up. But she stopped because I had so much attention in public. I imagine she did. But she continued to post her photographs because she finds life easier as Belle than she does as Mary. No one is going to speak to me if I am sat there not wearing anything to comment on, but if I'm wearing something crazy, people will say, "That's crazy," and start a conversation. I can't start a conversation with anyone. She soon reached 30,000 followers on Instagram. Her breakout was simple. She made an orgasm face. In hentai, animated Japanese pornography, if a girl is having intercourse and if she has an orgasm, they draw the orgasm in a very specific way. I made a video of me replicating this face. She does it for me. She rolls her eyes and sticks out her tongue. She earned 1 million followers in a month and 4.5 million within a year. 6 months after turning 18, she decided the only real way to make money is to be sexual online. I'm not sure how she feels about it because she contradicts herself. She says she loves boys, but also says, "I hate that I'm inspiring other people to do it." She says it is fun, but then says, "I understand it's everyone's worst nightmare to hear that your daughter's doing porn." But, she says, "I always get great satisfaction after posting it, because it feels like I have accomplished something." Her subscribers expect 30 to 40 updates a day. She usually begins with cosplay. She asks me kindly, "Do you know what that is?" I reply, "Is it like when I asked my husband to dress up as an owl?" "Not really." She is addicted to the attention, the affirmation, and the fear. To explain this, she describes the day she wore new boots when she was younger. "Everyone was looking at me. Everyone was laughing at me. I was hyper-conscious. I got that same feeling posting the first photo where I showed a bit of thigh. You look back and think, that's nothing to me now." She sounds amazed. After months of teasing, her first hardcore film will appear on Christmas Day. Her partner is in it, but without his face, because she is prettier than him. "I'm having that same scared feeling," she says. "After I take this leap, I suppose there will be no scared feeling anymore, because that is the furthest you can go." I wonder if this desire to expose herself is a yearning for acceptance. When you have shown everything, you have nothing left to give. Those who love you will love you, and those who hate you will hate you. In judgment there is peace. She says when she was thrown off Instagram, where she had 5.3 million followers, for sexual content, "I felt so irrelevant. All that weird, fake power I'd built up in my head that I thought I had. I was left with nothing. I felt irrelevant and small and defeated." She stayed away from the internet for a year. "What did you do?" "Nothing. I had no reason to do anything anymore." She sounds animated now, far more so when we were talking about sex, but that might be because she is more interested in marketing than sex. "I'm good for a YouTube thumbnail because I'm pink-haired and bright-eyed," she says happily. "I thought my life was going to be..." She pauses, looking for the word "shit." "I didn't go to school, I was uneducated." She looks at photographs of the rich and imagined them untouchable. Now she can have that. Belle can give it to her. She is searching for security, but the internet is a dangerous place to look. It's morally neutral like the sea. I ask her when she will stop. She doesn't know. She talks vaguely about a future life with a future family in which she will be a bourgeois mother at the school gates with a secret. I have to remind myself how young she is. I find her charming and touching, and I think of her as Rapunzel trapped in the tower, wondering when to let herself out. It won't be soon. She makes $1.2 million a month.
That was Tanya Gold, and now Lionel Shriver.
After the explosion of international self-abasement over George Floyd's killing in Minneapolis, much theatrical soul-searching ensued. So your basic man or woman on the street might have reason to puzzle why it is that in the wake of all this hyper-awareness about race, which the left simultaneously instructs us both does not exist and explains everything, relations between the hues seem only to decay. In order to redress structural racism, the state of Oregon, impressively still extant given the determination of both Nature and Portland's Antifa activists to burn it down, has reserved $62 million out of a total COVID relief fund of $200 million for black people. Black individuals who've suffered losses from government shutdowns can apply for grants of up to $3,000 per family, while black-owned businesses struggling during the pandemic can qualify for relief up to $100,000. If you are familiar with America's Northwestern demographics, the first peculiarity that leaps from this weighted state benevolence is its disproportion. This is Oregon. What black people? Only 2.9% of Oregonians are black. Yet close to a third of the relief fund is to be administered exclusively to this tiny, sanctified sliver of the population. Per capita, black applicants are bequeathed more than 10 times the financial assistance as residents of other races. Isn't that structural racism? Furthermore, by fostering resentment in the unanointed, this is a dubious formula for teaching everyone to get along. Likewise, problematic is the fact that 13.3% of the state is Latino. Though more than four times more populous than black residents, Hispanic Oregonians don't qualify for the Oregon Cares Fund for Black Relief and Resiliency. As Maria Garcia, owner of Portland's Revolucion Coffee House, has discovered, although her profits have withered from coronavirus restrictions, Ms. Garcia's application to the CARES Fund was declined because 0% of its owners identify as black. The cafe owner is now suing in federal court, arguing that a blacks-only fund violates the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. You'd think that the bald unconstitutionality of apportioning emergency assistance on the basis of race would be cut and dried. Unfortunately, previous Supreme Court rulings permitting race-based admissions to promote diversity in education and narrowly allowing the use of racial preferences in the awarding of state and federal contracts have muddied what should have remained clear constitutional waters. In recent decades, the whole foundational American principle of equality under the law has been eroded. So the U.S. now has bad racism and good racism. Of course, in the U.K., the very expression equality under the law draws a stupefied blank. In defiance of this fusty notion that laws should apply without fear or favor to everybody, Britain now preciously ring-fences protected characteristics, which means that a completely different set of laws applies to one group as opposed to another. Legally, white straight men live in another country. This disconcerting entrenchment of racial factionalism as a solution to racial factionalism has also been on display in the coverage of Joe Biden's appointments to be, starting first and foremost with his choice of vice president. The media overwhelmingly celebrated Kamala Harris, not for her accomplishments or her politics, but for her sex and race. Biden himself steered the country in an identity politics direction immediately after he was nominated by declaring that the primary qualification of his VP would be XX chromosomes. Given the fevered Floydian social atmosphere this summer, his subsequent obligation to choose not only a woman, but a woman who identifies as black, was a foregone conclusion from the off. Post-election, Biden's picks for cabinet and staff have been scrutinized by media commentators almost solely in accordance with their diversity. The number of blacks, women, Latinos, gays, etc. And broadcasters keep running tallies of which team is winning. As a stray example among dozens, The Guardian ran a headline in mid-November. Biden's first staff appointments include 5 women and 4 people of color. Think tank Brookings has posted pie charts of previous administration's appointees, white, black, Asian, Hispanic, Indian, and Arab. The better to keep track of whether Biden will beat his predecessors in the race race. Last week, the NAACP and black congressional leaders voiced their disappointment that only 1 of the 8 cabinet appointees whom Biden had so far announced was black, despite the fact that black Americans constitute just about exactly 1/8 of the population, if we're going to be that way. And it seems we are. When Biden's picks are admired by the New York Times or CNN, they're lauded almost exclusively in terms of his diversity scorecard. Broadly, yes, it's healthy for a government of a racially various country to itself be racially various. And I'm in no position to judge whether any of Biden's choices for powerful posts who improve his administration's appearance on a literally cosmetic level, are anything other than highly qualified for their jobs. But I am in a position to despair when journalistic colleagues commend these often personally and professionally impressive people purely on the basis of sex or race. Were I appointed deputy chief of staff, I'd be irked to be regarded as merely one more stroke in the female column. Surely distinguished black appointees don't appreciate being mere strokes in a column either. For any institution, diversity is necessarily a penultimate goal. Sitting around being diverse accomplishes nothing. What matters most is how Biden's cabinet members further the larger goals of his administration. We're stuck in a reductive way of thinking that plonks us in camps pitted against other camps. And this hiving off into teams in competition for zero-sum resources, be they COVID compensation funds or cabinet appointments, is only getting worse. Races, sexes, sexual identity cadres, and the disabled are being incentivized to operate like trade unions or lobbying factions, whose interests are mutually exclusive, and whose relations are therefore, if you will, structurally hostile. We've grown so numbly accustomed to raising category over character that we're forgetting how depressingly regressive this primitive tribal mindset is.
That was Lionel Shriver. And finally, Bruce Anderson.
We were celebrating the end of lockdown by talking about war and deer stalking over a business lunch, naturally. My friend David Matthew, from a distinguished legal, military and political family, told a story about Churchill's arrival in Athens at Christmas in 1944. David's father, Robert, then a young officer, was sent to meet the great man, who was grumpy and preoccupied, with good reason. He had come to save Greece from communism, with little guarantee of help from the Americans, let alone left-wing opinion in Britain. The sucking up to Uncle Joe Stalin may have been necessary to win the war. It would not be helpful for winning the peace. Robert and Churchill's arrival at the embassy was heralded by sniper fire, and young Matthew shoved the PM through the door. They landed in a heap. Churchill, Do you normally push prime ministers around? Mate Matthew, sir, I'd rather have an angry prime minister than a dead one. Churchill, what did you say your name was? Matthew, sir. Any relation of General Charles? My father, sir. Churchill's mood instantly softened. We charged together at Omdurman. Soon afterwards, Robert was a Tory candidate. Rory, a younger friend, had been shooting hydens in Perthshire. Deer stalking, the greatest of sports, is about as much fun as you can have wearing clothes. In my case, the pleasures may be past, for I have done too much stalking with knife, fork and glass. But it is good to listen to stalking talk. Although the highlands are festooned in winter, the only snowflakes there are ones that cover hills. Friends and stories about coping with the recent nonsense. One group found a restaurant which entertained them in an underground room. A man with a special forces background caught the mood. Must have been a bit like this in occupied France, having your dinner in a cellar while someone cocks an ear for the Gestapo. During the month of deprivation, I discovered another hazard, which threatens to endure into normal times. You cannot trust supermarket cheese. Sainsbury's and Waitrose have been deceiving their customers. You see a rusty-looking camembert, but when you scrutinise the small print, you find it is made from pasteurised milk. This is presumably some dastardly French plot to exploit British ignorance. Our supermarkets compound the outrage by claiming that the cheese is adulterated for safety's sake. Rubbish. I did discover an alternative from Brittany. I'm surprised it's allowed to call itself camembert, but it is indistinguishable from the proper Norman stuff. It should not be so hard to find proper cheese rather than ersatz made from chalk to suit the palates of snowflakes. That said, toasts were raised to the French at another post-lockdown business luncheon. We drank three magnificent bottles. The first was a Chablis Grand Cru Blanchot 2016 from the House of Drouin, which has been in business for 400 years. In those centuries, I wonder if they have ever eaten pasteurized cheese. No, that is an insulting suggestion. The wine had everything and in harmony. Fruit, acid, honey, flint. Some of us thought that we had never tasted a better Chablis. Even so, it will evolve further over the coming years. The second white was an Hospice de Beaune Meursault Genvrière 2002. Straight from the pouring, it seemed to be showing its age. There was plenty of structure. Was there enough fruit? But it opened out. We decided it should have been decanted and given a little more time. Still, it was delicious. We finished with a Côte d'Estournelle 2005, a really serious claret. Mature now, it will last for decades. Good fellowship, outstanding wine. The lockdown receded into the distance. That is the place for it.
That was Bruce Anderson. Thanks for listening to this episode of Spectator Out Loud, and do join us again next week.
£12 weeks for £12. Subscribe to The Spectator for this excellent deal and get a £20 Amazon voucher at www.spectator.co.uk/voucher.